Hey, welcome to Short Fine Legs, the podcast as timeless as a James Anderson away swinger, but without the side order of grumpiness that old Jimmy usually brings. I'm Daniel Gallen, freelance hack for hire, and as always, I'm looking at my screen where professional cricketer Nono Pongolo is stationed. Nons, good to see your face. How's your week been?
Yeah, thank you again, Bert. It's good to be back on another episode. It's been a good week of training. The weather has been good for us in Johannesburg this week. And yeah, I really enjoyed it again. Like I said, it's continuing the boring stuff in the nets. Still yeah. Practicing my leave. Still getting one or two wrong and getting bowled in my off stump. So it's been, continuing from that. Like, it's been really good again. Been an interesting week from off the field though.
Nice. I myself have returned to training this week after breaking my finger a month ago. And the first ball that I bowled, I was in the wrong net. I found myself training with the first team, and I was bowling to Luke Holman, who is an England under 19 player who also plays for Middlesex. And I bowled just a loopy full toss, and he just spanked me about 100 meters over my head, and I was like, okay, that's very humbling. I think I'm gonna go bowl where I belong with the threes and the fours. So my reintroduction to cricket wasn't amazing, but it was nice. It's nice to be back on the park. Like you said, another interesting week in South African cricket. Director of cricket at CSA, Graham Smith, shot back at Tami Tsolakile, whose three-part chat with Robert Marawa dropped this week. A lot of backwards and forwards, lines are being drawn. Almost a rewriting of history, where I feel like I've seen a lot of people try and argue that Abe de Villiers wasn't the greatest wicketkeeper batsman of all time. And I think that's important, like we said, to chew gum and walk at the same time. We can believe that Tami Tsolakile got a rough deal, but that it also kind of worked out in the end, and also that he was a victim of circumstance, but also was a match fixer, was at least a convicted match fixer. And it's been hard to kind of hold these two almost dual positions. Have you struggled to kind of chew gum and walk at the same time? Nons, how have you navigated the this week?
Yeah, it's been I think the word is sad. It's been a sad week just still continue to learn about these stories of past Proteus players, and especially in the Graham Smith era. We've seen that Monde Zondeki as well has shared his experience. Okay. And it's been really difficult to of course, kind of listen to these stories for me as well. But I was actually very happy that I think we finally heard from Smith what his views were. And of course, I mean, you don't want the back and forth. But I think what Tami needed to get out was to obviously mention that his story as well is similar to a Makaya. And we need to be aware that, players went through these experiences, and we need to do better in going forward. And that's why it's important that whenever this Proteus team get together and be able to forge a new path in terms of how we treat players, how we manage players going forward. So for me, I'm not going to delve into too much of the details of back and forth and what was said in the statement, etc. It's just that, it's been a somber week. It's just that I hope, again, we take plenty of lessons from what has happened in the past. I think there's plenty for us to definitely look at and say we need to do better. And, we've got an opportunity to create a new path for a Proteus team, one where it's diverse, it's inclusive, and it's for everyone. And that truly reflects our country.
No, Nons, that's well said, man. And like you say, it's hard listening, but important listening. But, we here at Short Fine Legs are not afraid to get into these debates and conversations, and there's no overtly right side of history, but I like to think that we are on the right side of this debate in many ways, but we are still learning. But we're not going to get into it this week because we've got a very special guest, Stephen Cook, obviously the former Proteas batter and just a Lions legend. I mean, maybe if you were compiling a best ever 11 of domestic cricket after after unification, you'd probably have Stephen opening the batting and maybe even captaining the side. I mean, I don't think you can really downplay what a legend of domestic cricket this guy is. Just before we get into this conversation with Stephen, particularly around captaincy, I mean, Nons, you joined the Lions when Stephen had already established himself, you know, his status. Just your thoughts on the first time you met him, what he's like in the dressing room, what he's like as a person. Yeah, just kind of any anecdotes that you'd like to share.
I think anyone that knows Stephen Cook would know that he's not someone with plenty of words in the change room, but you definitely know where he wants the team, which direction he wants the team. And I think that's one of his main attributes in terms of off the field. I mean, it's someone that you can go to. He will come to you and give you quite clear instructions on what needs to be done and what needs to be happen. What needs to happen. And I think in terms of the time as well at the Lions, someone who had a really strong relationship with Jeff Toyana, and I think that definitely worked really well for them. That you know, they could bounce off things off each other. And on top of that, I think in terms of where the team was post 2016 as well, it was a very inexperienced side, and we needed an experienced player to obviously lead the team through those dark days, to obviously where the Lions have got out to now in terms of being able to win trophies in the past couple of seasons. So you needed someone with the know-how and making sure that the ship doesn't go in the wrong direction in that particular time. As we actually talked about in our previous chat, that it wasn't an easy period, but at no stage did I ever feel that the team didn't know what they needed to do. So he's the one of those guys who's very meticulous in what the team needs to do in terms of planning. He's very clear what direction he wants the team to take. So it's got to do with the freedom that I think Jeff Toyana gave him as well as a coach, to give him the responsibility to lead the team in his image, I guess.
Mm. And just before we get into it, your personal relationship with him, did you have the relationship of player coach where he would, you know, give you the hairdryer treatment? Would he put an arm around your shoulder? Did he kind of do a bit of both? I mean, would you guys, was he the kind of captain who would get the boys around for a beer after training? What sort of relationship did you have with him personally?
I think, Stephen Cook, Cookie, as we call him in the change room, is definitely your senior pro. Someone who came in earlier than everyone, worked hard, probably was the last person to leave as well. So I would say, I mean, it's important for both parties to make the effort to each other. And I'll say in my early days in the Lions, I was definitely more quiet, just making sure that I did my part as well as I can to get into the side. Not necessarily being out there with your leadership group and communicated as much as I should have. We definitely forged a better relationship more closer to the end, because, you know, I felt that, you know, if I didn't feel something being done to me in terms of selection or whatever as captain, I would send a text to him and say, this is my view, or can we have this chat? And we actually share, and we actually had a really healthy, you know, conversations about those things. So my first part of being in the Lions was definitely, I was more of a quiet person. And I think by the end, we definitely were better connected in understanding each other. So I think it's an important part of captaincy in terms of understanding players and the change room. We're very diverse in South Africa. Mm. And it's a responsibility on all parties to obviously try to have that relationship and understanding of each other, because at the end of the day, when you're under pressure, you want someone standing next to you that you can trust, and he also trusts you that you can execute and do well in those situations.
Yeah. All right, let's get into it. Here is our chat with Stephen Cook. Our very special guest today is a man who played 11 tests for South Africa, scoring 300s, one on debut, hitting 632 runs at 33.26. For the better part of 20 years, he was a stalwart of domestic cricket and a one-club man with the Lions, scoring a whopping 15,396 runs from 229 first-class matches, averaging a shade under 40 with 4,860 50s. He holds the record for the highest ever score in South African domestic cricket with a frankly ridiculous tally of 390. It is our pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Stephen Cook. Stephen, how's it? Thanks for joining us.
Daniel, how's it? And Nona, how's it? And yeah, good to be on and yeah, chatting cricket, a game I love so much. So yeah, great.
Steve, my first question for you is, after scoring that ton on debut, how often have you reminded your dad that he scored a duck in his first ever test innings?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, being a son of a South African test player as well, I mean, obviously lends itself to certain interesting conversations. I mean, my old man, every first-class 100 I got in my entire career, he would phone me up at the end of the day's play, same line as I answer the phone. Well done, my boy. 20 down, another 46 to go, whatever it was till I got to this. So, yeah, I mean, it was always nice to rub a couple in his face, you know what I mean? He phoned me. I mean, I've told the story many times. He phoned me the morning of my test debut, and he said, boy, if you just don't get out first ball, you've done better than me. So, yeah, there was a very low expectation, I suppose. But, yeah, I suppose always to get one over my old man. I mean, I knew I was never going to get as many hundreds as him and as many runs, but, you know, maybe a test 100 and a higher score higher than him. Some bragging rights around the dinner table.
Yeah. Yeah, you say that, you know, you weren't going to get as many as him because obviously you weren't going to get the chance to play as many games or whatever the case was as a lot of other players. I mean, your name features in a recent Crick Info article published on Thursday titled "Domestic Toilers Who Waited Their Turn." And this is in light of Pakistan's forward Alam making his return to the test side after 11 years. You had to wait 15 years, essentially, for your first crack. I mean, did you ever think that it just wouldn't happen? Had you accepted that you were just never going to put on the Protea badge?
Yeah, I mean, domestic toiler. I mean, but that's, I mean, I'll take that, I suppose. Take whatever you can get. You know, to be honest, I never did. I always thought there was a chance. I think if I didn't think there was a chance, I would have stopped. I would have given it up. But I always felt there was a chance. I needed, you know, this is the thing with cricket. I mean, it's a cruel game. It's a cruel game. You can be playing so well and there's no place because someone's playing a bit better than you. I mean, for the best part of my career, I mean, Graham Smith, Gary Kirsten, Herschel Gibbs, they held the position that I was going for. I mean, these are greats of the game, you know. To even be considered in their company would be amazing, you know. So it wasn't always necessarily about what I did. It was sometimes about just what was there. And, you know, finally at 33, 34, that opportunity came. And, I mean, that was just an honor. I mean, I always just said I want one test. And, I mean, after that first test, you always want one more and one more. So, you know, to have got 11, I was really blessed. So,
is that why you never went on a cold pack or kind of never did a prolonged stint in Australia or the UK maybe? Because you always thought that test call-up was potentially around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that both could really happen. I mean, I knew that once, you know, I really wanted to play for South Africa. That was my main ambition. And then, you know, once that chapter had closed, like a Hashim Amla or a Morne Morkel, then there could be that call-back down the line, which they didn't end up being. And I'm perfectly okay with that. I've got no regrets for how things ended. But yeah, for me, it was always that dream of just playing for South Africa. I think probably spurred on by the fact that my old man had played. That probably played a massive role in it. But I mean, it's the game I love. And I mean, like I've documented previously, I mean, there were many crossroads in my career, times where I could have hung it up. And I don't think anyone would have begrudged me stopping, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. To see, you know, I mean, I was lucky enough to study law and to see a lot of those classmates, you know, eventually become partners in firms, and there you are toiling out on the cricket field somewhere. You know, it does make you question what you're doing, you know. So, but the drive to play for South Africa was stronger than that. And I knew that, you know, even post cricket, there's plenty of years to do something else. I was always going to regret if I stopped too early. And I'm grateful that I continued and I got the opportunity to continue.
Mm. Cookie, you were a one-man, you're a one-club man, if I can put it, and I mean, representing the Lions well for many, many years. And of course, being an opening batter in one of the most difficult grounds to be an opener at, being the Wanderers, Imperial Wanderers now, did you ever consider at any stage to maybe moving to a different franchise to make it maybe slightly easier for yourself, or was it always just the place that you always wanted to play your cricket at?
Yeah, I think my heart was always at the Wanderers, and it would have taken a lot to move away. I mean, there obviously were times, especially when I was only playing red ball cricket, I wasn't getting any white ball opportunities, that I thought about maybe moving away. But I think part and parcel, I mean, you know, towards the back end of my career, people spoke a lot about my technique and how strange it looked. It didn't always look like it. It sort of evolved because of the tough batting conditions that I played under, and you become sort of a product of how you play. So, you know, it looked all crabby, and I mean, by my own admission, it was pretty messy towards the end. But it was sort of what I had to do to survive. And yeah, I suppose with Lions having a second ground in Poch, which is also pretty good to bat on, that probably balanced it out a little bit. I mean, had we not had Poch and every game was at the Wanderers, that might have been a tough call to, you know, you've got to average 40 plus to get a crack for South Africa, probably at the top of the order. So, you know, if I wasn't able to do that because you're playing at the Wanderers, difficult conditions, that would have been tough. But yeah, certainly made it very enjoyable when you got to go bat on nice wickets, you know, down in Paarl or somewhere flat like that. So, yeah.
That's interesting that you say that, Nonz. It's such a good question, because maybe, Nonz, you can also answer it. Like, do you guys as professionals consider where you're based with, if you've got aspirations to make the next level? I mean, if you're a spin bowler and you're toiling away on a flat wicket because you play for the Knights or whatever the case is, do you kind of consider then moving down maybe to Durban if you are an opening bat? I mean, in Cape Town where it seems, or in Joburg where it bounces, do you maybe think, okay, I want to go somewhere else? Does that play a role? Nonz, Cookie, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I think it definitely plays a role. I think, you know, and there's more to it even than that, than the conditions. You know, it can be the chemistry of the bowling attack. You know, let's say you're playing in a team that doesn't have a very strong attack. Opposition players tend to sort of see you out, block you out, and then score off the lesser bowlers. So in that, you know, in that instance, sometimes it's actually better to go play in a team where it's harder to make the team, because they need to play you differently. I mean, I remember early on in my career where up at Gauteng Lions, David Tabruka was our main bowler. And you could see how opposition teams would literally see him off because we didn't have the quality of backup. When he played for South Africa, all of a sudden, you know, the Australians used to have to try and take him on because you had, you know, Pollock and whatever and Tini at the other end. So, you know, that can sometimes play a role. Yeah, and I mean, certain conditions suit certain types of bowlers. And I think there are many players who sort of look back and say, oh, maybe I should have made a move, because so often we see guys make a move and it's really good for their career. I suppose there are the odd case where it doesn't work out. But yeah, I think, for me, it definitely does play a role, especially in South Africa where the conditions do vary significantly. You know, your PE versus the Wanderers, you know, at times could be, you might as well be playing on a different planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, Dan, I think Cookie's definitely hit the nail on its head there. But for me, I always considered the coaches have been vital to the environment that I wanted myself to be in. So it was kind of made easier that way, to, if I can trust the person that's in charge. It felt that, you know, I could learn as much as possible. And I think that's one of the keys to the Lions in the past years, is that you've always had guys pushing to play for South Africa. So there was always a trickling of information down to the lower age groups or whatever, academy and all that stuff. And of course, learning and watching those international players train, how they go about their business. It was always obviously nice to see that, you know, face on and actually see how they operate. That's why I always say, I think, it's difficult for guys at the Knights, for example, that you don't have so many internationals, to not see how a Stephen Cook operates, or Kagiso Rabada, or Themba Bavuma. And for me, if you don't have those examples, it does make that step slightly harder for the next batch of players. So I think for me, it was always a consideration of all those things. And it is, like Kiki said as well, important to make the move at the right time, of course, and for the right reasons as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. Because I think so often, that's a really key point. So often it's, you know, the coaches are important. Agreed. You know, you want to work under certain people that can assist with your skills, but it's often the guys you play with. And I reckon one of the biggest parts of my development was I got to bat with a Neil McKenzie, with and Alvaro Pedersen, those sort of guys were the guys you battled with. So in the heat of battle, that's where you learned your skill. You didn't have to wait to get off the field for the coach to debrief you to improve. You could fix something and implement it there in the moment, you know. And I think even the legacy that has continued at the Lions, say, for instance, in the batting department particularly, was off the basis of players before that, you know, guys like Rusty Tembo who played under similar lineages of players, you know. So yeah, I think that's important. You need to look at who can support your game. You look at the Cobras in the Western Cape, you had your guy like Vernon Philander and those guys coming through based on Charles Langefeld standing there at mid-on, you know, like just the sharing of information in the moment. This is how we get it done. You see how Broad and Anderson do it for England in the moment. They're learning together, you know, hunting as a pack. So yeah, I think it does play a big role.
Well, let's move the conversation to captaincy, as this is kind of the crux of this week's show. Steve, it's quite a broad question, but maybe we can start big and narrow it down. I mean, what is the secret to being a good captain? I mean, obviously every skipper will have different ways of leading their team, but is there kind of a universal trait that you can say all captains need to have?
Yeah, I think captaincy is multifaceted. I think, I mean, it's, you know, and so much as leadership in general. I mean, you know, there's on the field, there's off the field. I mean, which often, and you find very few captains who can do that both really well. You've got the tactical side of the game. You sometimes find really good tactical captains. They're astute. They can read the game where they're at, but then can't communicate properly with their players to be able to implement it. They're three steps ahead of where their player is. Right. They're setting fields for balls the bowler can't bowl. You find other guys that are great communicators. The guys are fully behind that captain. They're passionate. They believe in him. You know, the unit's tight. But, you know, when you need the second slip to be in position, the captain is not reading the game. There's no second slip. You know, so, I mean, I'm giving silly examples.
Well, what kind of captain were you?
I think I was a captain, and I think you are inspired. I mean, the debate really goes, you know, are leaders, are captains born, or are they, you know, created? And I think it's a bit of a hybrid. I think you do have a sort of natural tendency towards leadership, you know, to make it binary, the wolf or the sheep. But even in that, there's so much learned experience, the way we brought up, the people we with, the situations we put in. And sometimes you need to sink or swim. And for me, I found I did have leadership capabilities. I might not be your natural leader. You know, people might not have looked at me and said, hey, this guy's our natural leader. But I did have some attributes that lent itself towards leading. But I also learned a lot from the people that I played with. I was really lucky to play with some seriously good captains who had a variety of those mix of skills. You know, I take a guy like Neil McKenzie, great personality, dealt with people really well, was able to be honest and upfront and, you know, create a nice relaxed environment. Not to say that he wasn't good tactically, but you get a guy, I had a guy like H.D. Ackerman, who was my captain early on, who was exceptional tactically, exceptional. Maybe by his own admission at times, maybe not as strong on the people management as Anil, but tactically, sure, unbelievable. And so you start to pick up things here and there. And I mean, I remember many hours, you know, standing there in the field and you watch how things are done and you sort of subconsciously it comes into you. And I'm sure people who played with me a lot will start to see those things over time. Hey, that thing that Cookie does there, you know, Mackie used to do that, or someone, you pick it up like that. And I think the really great captains, the real top-notch are the guys who can merge those two together, who can create synergy, who can get, have a realistic expectation of their team, have the relationships with their team members, but also be raising them to a level that's sort of above. So, yeah, I think it's sort of, and also the team that you have at a time in a culture can be, you can be a fantastic captain for a certain team at a certain time, like a coach. There's some coaches who are just perfect for a new team, you know, young guys, not much experience, rebuilding. They're brilliant for that. They're poor with teams of senior players who are established. You get other guys who are great managers. Once the systems are in place, they'll make sure the guys will play for the team and all that. So it's got a life cycle. And I felt that even in my captaincy, I got to the stage and that's why eventually I resigned. I got to the end of my life cycle. I remember standing up in a team meeting and there just wasn't that feeling back to me. The team had moved on from me and my style of leadership. and it needed something new. And it actually proved to be perfect because Temba came and took over at the Lions, and it was exactly what the team needed. The team needed that change, that type of character, and off he went. So, you know, that's why it's very hard for people to say, oh, that guy would be a good captain or not. It's dependent on where a team's at, yeah. You know. And, I mean, you see countless examples of around the world where, you know, someone, you think, oh, I don't know, I think you'd be a great captain. But if the right guy at the right time might be the perfect captain. Just the last thing that I just had on my mind is, it's amazing how sometimes we view ourselves completely differently as leaders to what other people see ourselves as.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a webinar with Faf du Plessis a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about, and the question was asked, does he see himself as a better sort of tactical captain or a man management captain? And he said he saw his strength massively tactical, much wow. stronger than his personal. But yet, having played under him, I would have seen it completely the other way around. And I said it to him, I said, to me, you are one of the best man managers. You brought together a team of diverse people to play together after a tough time. I mean, he took over after a lot of turmoil, after that Indian tour, Hash and AB and everyone had a crack. And yet he saw himself tactically that way. I mean, I remember in Perth, the test where Dale Steyn broke down, you know, his off-field stuff, I think, outweighed what he did. I mean, everyone says, oh, it was brilliant how he worked with the bowlers and he was a bowler down and whatever. I just think how he got everyone on the same page to believe that we could still win the test a bowler down, which no one had done. No one had won in Australia with a bowler down.
Yeah.
But it was that man management side. So although it looks sometimes outwardly like it's a tactical thing, there's maybe a different layer. So it's very complex to answer your question. Yeah.
Mm. I actually want to ask you about the importance of the relationship now between you and the head and the coach, because I mean, you were post that the unfortunate 2016 match fixing saga. You obviously have to be able to pick up the change room from there. And you went from a really experienced international core of players to a younger team. How was that relationship now with the coach, and how important it is for you obviously to be given the freedom, or the coach had to maybe step in a little bit more to run the ship for the team in that period?
Yeah, I mean, like you say, it's always moving parts. You need to adapt and change constantly. If you're going to come with one approach one season and try copy paste the next season, it's not going to work. So, I mean, you've got to constantly evolve. And I mean, I try to do it to best of my ability. And I know there were times where I got things horribly wrong, and I'll be the first to put my hand up. There were times where I managed players poorly. There were times when I had to apologize for the way that I did things. And I mean, you know, I'd like to think, I mean, I can think of countless examples. I mean, I can remember one with you where over a selection issue, we communicated poorly and we had to have a hard conversation about it. And I learned and I grew from that. So I think that's the first thing you've got to realize. You don't know everything as a leader. But certainly, I mean, most of my captaincy was under Jeff Tuiana. And we got on really well because he realized what was my strengths, where he could let me have some reign. And where he was good, you know. So I think that synergy is really important between captain and coach. And I mean, there are always difficulties. I mean, some people say, oh, it's tough to captain a bunch of senior players. Others say, oh, it's tough when the guys are young and they're learning. Yeah, they've got their pros and their cons with it. But yeah, I mean, that coach captain relationship, really important. And I think you can evolve, and I think you can adjust, and it's about that communicating and actually realizing when you get it wrong. I think we're so stubborn to think we know all the answers all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's something, the older I've got and the more experience I've got, I don't have all the answers. And we should actually say sometimes, I don't know, instead of trying to, you know, waffle on as if we do know. Just say, you know, well, you tell me, you know, ask a question back sometimes is the best question.
Yeah. Nuan's touched on something so interesting there about the 2016 match fixing saga. I mean, the Lions were rocked harder by it than any other franchise. And in a way, I wonder if that maybe helps sometimes. I mean, you think of the great South African captains of recent times. Faf, you've mentioned he picked up a team that was kind of lost in its way. Graham picked up a team that was in complete disarray following the Hunsie scandal. And obviously, Hunsie himself picked up a team that was transitioning into the new South Africa. does it sometimes help a new captain to rebuild a very broken system rather than inheriting a team that is already succeeding, that is already doing well, where things are in place? Because you, as the captain, I imagine you want to come in and you want to kind of put your own mark on things. Is it easier to do that when the pieces are all over the place as opposed to something already that's quite whole?
Yeah, I think it comes down to change. You know, people are generally resistant to change. And sometimes when those barriers have been completely broken down, there's no other option other than change. And people's minds are open. You can be saying something, and if the people's minds aren't open to hearing, if the players aren't willing to change or be open to their change, well, you're not going to get any meaningful change anyway. And so that perhaps it does give you a line in the sand. I like that as a phrase sometimes, just that line in the sand. Right, let's move forward from that point. I mean, yeah, I certainly went through a couple of different eras. I actually started captaining just before the match fixing saga. So yeah. I had a season with, you know, all the big guns, so to speak, you know, when Alvira and Lopsy and Tommy and everyone, Neil Mack, we had a really experienced side. To the year when the match fixing saga happened, I just did the Red Bull stuff that year. And Tommy, we had a split captaincy for that season. And then I took over after that again. So yeah, all the seasons are different. And I mean, yeah, we all of a sudden got a rush of new players who were young and, you know, we had to make do. And yeah, I suppose you look back on those, I mean, difficult times, you know, difficult times. You know, you tend to actually erase those difficult times just to cope, just to get through. I can remember many hours sitting with Jeff Toyonis, you know, how are we going to get around this? How are we going to get the squad working? And eventually, I mean, that's why I say you've got a lifespan, I think, as a captain, as a leader sometimes, well, certainly in an environment where I'd played all my cards. I didn't have any more tricks to add, you know, so, and I've played in teams where, you know, there was the best thing possible. And at the Lions, we've generally done it pretty well over the years. You know, Neil Mack got to a stage, handed over to Alvira. Alvira handed over to me in many senses, and you know, now Timber's lead. So you've got a lifespan, and I think that succession is really important. That you earmarking leaders or guys that have that leadership capability to take over. So there's not, you know, just a dearth of leadership. I think that's important too.
Mm. Actually, just on that point, I mean, are we doing enough in terms of that succession planning of captaincy? I mean, you look around and now, the fact that there's this talk of who is the possible captain of the test side, are we doing enough in making sure that, you know, like under you, there was Temba initially who was vice captain to you. Dominic Hendricks was also one of the guys that was given that responsibility, took over from you as well. You've had Aidan Markram at the Titans being given responsibility, Klaassen. Is there enough planning around who our future leaders are going to be in the country at the moment? Or are we just kind of it's kind of going with the flow at the moment? Or is there some sort of a plan to always have some sort of a strong leader always in charge of our teams?
Mm. Yeah, I think sometimes the situation that you get faced with, and maybe it's prevalent, maybe it's applicable at the moment in South Africa, and maybe it's not so much, but, you know, you always want your captain to be not the first name necessarily on the team sheet, but needs to be rock solid in their position. You don't want to be sort of umming and ahhing about their position. But you also mustn't eliminate the obvious leader. You know, there have been countless great leaders who were fringe players maybe in the abilities, and they sort of get by. But when you moneyball their abilities, yes, the guy might only average 35, but he saves you 15 runs from captaincy. So he actually averages 50. Mm. You know, that's sometimes quite hard to quantify. So, and sometimes something that you've got to weigh in, you know. So, you know, just as an example, you know, some people might say, okay, Temba Bavuma, test captain or not test captain, he's averaging you know, just over 30, he's got only got 100. But if he's the right man, if he's the right captain and he can bring that team together and effectively score 20 runs in innings with his captaincy, well, he averages 50, then he's top draw, then he must be your man. You know, so I think that's sometimes the tough lap is, do you have the best captain? And I mean, I'm just using Temba as an example. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case. You know, if you had said 2 years ago, Aidan Markram, you know, averaging 45 in test cricket, young guy, maybe the obvious candidate, goes through a bit of a rough patch. Now you're saying, well, what is that captaincy worth? You know, is it 10 runs? Is it 20 runs? You know, so, and I think in different teams, it's worth different things. Obviously, in South Africa, we had a captain in Graham Smith for a huge period of time. And in a way that almost didn't encourage more leadership. You probably find there would have been more guys getting leadership experience had that not been the case. But be it as it may, young, really good players, guys who you probably say could be your captains, sometimes get elevated up teams quite quickly and therefore never gain that experience. And I think that's what you sometimes end up with. You end up with a guy who's, I mean, much like Quinton, one of the best players in the world, who up until a year ago hadn't really captained any senior team. And yet, when given the opportunity, everyone says, gee, this guy's actually a damn good captain. Because he is. He's cricket smart. He's savvy. He knows what's going on. And because of how he rose so quickly, if you think about it, if he had risen slower through the provincial ranks, he might have been captaining a franchise team for a couple of seasons. But he rose so quickly that he almost missed that part of his development as a leader. Aidan Markram might have been the same. Instead of, you know, have been captain of the Titans for two or three seasons, he was playing Test cricket maybe a season earlier than everyone would have liked because there was a gap at the top of the order, and all of that. So, yeah, and also, I mean, the other issue that comes up is bowlers as captains. You know, the history of the game suggests that batsmen 90% of the time are the captains. But does that mean you can't have a bowler as a captain? You know, there are downsides, but, you know, I mean, in the South African context, Keshav Maharaj, one of the better cricket minds going around. You know, you talk to me tactically on the field, I think he's excellent. But if you make him captain, does that mean that you're going to play a spinner every game? You know, you get a green top with the Wanderers. I don't know. I'm playing devil's advocate here, but those are the decisions that you've got to go. Do you go for someone who's, you know, maybe captains for 2 years while you develop your next leader? Or do you say, listen, we're going to go the route that we went to the Graham Smith and, you know, we'll go all in on someone and hope it sticks, a younger guy.
My next question, Kugie, was regards to responsibility of being a franchise captain in South Africa, knowing how diverse our backgrounds are, and especially now that we've got to hear some of the stories, how great is that responsibility on you leading that environment?
Yeah, I mean, it always is. I mean, it's a huge responsibility to be a leader in any industry. I mean, sport particularly, which is, I mean, it's cutthroat. It's ruthless. And there's a lot of moving parts. I think that's what sometimes, you know, is not so obvious. You can be doing everything right and you get left out of a side. And, you know, that time out, your mind wanders and you start, the demons come in. I mean, I've had it. I've been left out of plenty of teams where you just think there's no ways I should be left out, or, you know, I can't believe that I was treated like that. But, you know, it's sometimes those tough knocks, and it's to balance those tough knocks with being compassionate enough and understanding, you know, your players that you're with and understanding, I mean, the diversity that we have. I mean, we have an incredible diversity and we're richer for it. I think that's the thing, and I've definitely seen that. I mean, you get guys who have a different way of thinking to you, come at things with a different angle on life, and that, if harnessed correctly, makes your team better, not worse. I think that's essential. You want to be greater than the sum of your parts. That's really where you want to get to. And I mean, you can have a team where guys speak different languages, different cultures, different religions, all of that sort of all melts together. But if you can have sort of some common threads that you can all relate to a certain level, everyone's not going to be best friends. I can guarantee you that. I think if you think that's going to, everyone's going to just like be harmonious and there'll be no issues, you know, show me that team. I'd love to know what they did. But obviously, if you're moving in that direction, there's a huge responsibility. And some will do it better than others. And when we talk leadership and who should lead, you know, Proteus teams and stuff like that, that's one of the factors. Can that person bring all the diverse people together? You know, I mean, yes, we are unique in South Africa in a certain sense, but there are other challenges in other countries. You think about an IPL, that's also bringing together some different cultures, some different things. You bring, you know, some of the highest earners, you know, there can be pay gaps, pay disparities that, you know, you can have a young Indian player there who's, you know, just been picked up, you know, first season as a rookie from Mumbai, and he's playing with, you know, a Virat Kohli, who's, I mean, multi-millionaire, And just like that's diversity too, you know. So in a totally different sense, of course.
Speaking of understanding players, and you know, Nonce touches on something quite interesting, which is culture and the diversity in South Africa. But I also wonder, does a captain need to understand what struggle is like? You know, we often, one of the accusations leveled at AB de Villiers, for example, when he was captain, is that because he was such a freak with the bats, you know, he could do things that mortals couldn't do. He couldn't quite understand what it was like to struggle out in the middle. I mean, I remember watching him against Mitch Johnson at Centurion, where it looked like the scariest thing in the world. Misoak was cutting him off the back foot and watching it like it was like the size of a pumpkin. Do you know what I mean? Graham Smith selected into the side as a 22-year-old, kind of his, you know, his career is kind of a series of green lights for much of the career. Does a captain need to understand what it's like to be dropped, what it's like to struggle, what it's like to be out of form? Or is that just sort of an extra feather in the cap and not necessarily an important thing that a captain needs?
No, I think it's a really important part. And I don't think it's necessarily dependent on how good you are to be able to do that. You can be a top-notch player, but be able to relate to a player who's struggling. It's the same as coaching. It's not to say the best players, you know, make the best coaches or don't make the best coaches. It's a different skill, you know. And I think that's what you've got to appreciate, you know. And I think that's the debate at the moment a lot in South Africa, especially when it comes to coaching, is do you go for the career coach who maybe didn't play at the top level, but has worked through his coaching badges and he's done the levels and he's done the hard graft. Is he a better coach than the guy who played international cricket for 15 years, didn't do a coaching course, and then, you know? Both have their ups and downs, you know. Is a captain who's a genius better? Well, possibly he sees the game, he sees it unfold. He doesn't have to stress about his own performance as much. So maybe there's an advantage there versus the just your everyday guy. I mean, and I definitely felt like I fell into that category where, you know, I had above average ability, but not exceptional. And I had to graft really hard for it. So I understood what it sometimes took. I'd been left out plenty of times. So, you know, I sort of knew that. Whether that then comes across is another story, you know. And that's probably where I'm most critical of my career is, did I know something? Did I feel something in my gut, even if it wasn't expressly there, and then not quite act and go far enough? And, I mean, to a certain degree, you probably succeed or fail. It's probably not binary. It's probably one way or the other. But I mean, through a number of, I don't like to bring personal examples into it, but I remember a spinner, Eddie Lee, and you know, at the Lions, and we went through a phase where we just didn't have the synergy going as a captain and spin bowler, and you really need that because you need to understand what he's doing, and he needs to understand where you're going in order for it to actually work. And I mean, in that case, it took an outside intervention, but we had a sort of sports psychologist loosely involved at one stage, and they helped me as a captain. I mean, a lot of it was actually probably to do with me and Jeff, helped to get the best out of our players. And this guy gave some great insights into him, insights that I probably could have, had I actually gone the extra mile, maybe achieved by myself. But he sort of helped me to have that conversation so that I could relate better to the player, that I knew in the pressure situation, how can I get that 10% out of him? And I definitely felt that after that point, we definitely had a better rapport, that I would trust what he was doing better and he would trust what I was doing, and that we weren't actually fighting at it. And it wasn't because our views had changed or how he bowled or whatever, but it's purely because we had a common point that we could now reference and say, okay, this is where the conversation starts in the heat of battle. Because it's easy when you're sitting there in a change room. That's easy. That's the easy conversation. It's when it's out there and you've got a hostile fast bowler who he wants his second slip, you know, and you can't have a show down there at the top of the mark on national television, you know. You have to have a point of departure. And yeah, that's where the man management side is tricky. You know, it's those tough conversations off the park, you know, leaving guys out, that sort of stuff. It's tough conversations, those decisions in, you know, people are very critical of captains sitting on their couches or sitting in the change room, you know, go and make that decision. You've got the umpire in your ear saying you're behind on the over rate. Now you're changing the field, the back end of a T20 game. You're going to make the odd mistake. I can guarantee you that much, you know, and if you're scared to act, that's maybe another point is with all of this. If you're then scared to act because of, for whatever reason, if you're scared to say something to a player because you feel like it's going to come across badly, or then you're in trouble, because you need to be able to have that conversation. You need to be able to say what you want to say.
What about, you go ahead. Me? Okay, I'll go. What about captaining a genius? You know, because, in a conversation we once had, Steve, for a profile I wrote on Quinton de Kock, you shared the anecdote where you were watching Nathan Lyon bowl on TV, and Quinton, like almost as if to no one, was just saying, oh, this is how I'll play him. And you told me, oh, okay, Quinton, it's easier said than done. And then he went and faced him, and he did that exact same thing. And for me, that I use that anecdote in the piece because that just speaks to Quinton's genius, quite frankly. Is it harder to captain the Mavericks? Is it harder to captain the guys who can do things that you yourself as a captain perhaps can't do? Or is it actually easier? Okay, well, that's one guy I don't have to worry about. He can just go and do his same thing and he'll win us a game on his own. How do you captain the geniuses?
Captaining and coaching the geniuses, sometimes the make or break of a leader. And there's that tipping point. There's that point where by them being the Maverick and doing things slightly differently, do they detract from the greater good? You know, there's that point, and it's such a hard one to judge. You know, you can think of countless examples over the years where, you know, a guy was just given that bit of leeway and he won games and he made a guy look fantastic. It's also relative to the team you play in. For me, I mean, I suppose in my time I played with some Maverick players. I mean, a captain, some guys. I mean, maybe not to the AB de Villiers sort of degree. I mean, that's maybe to the extreme. But you need to sometimes, you know, give people a little bit of leeway. You know, everyone falls back, you know, when people are treated slightly differently, double standard was applied. I've almost looked at it from a point of view and say, there has to be different standards applied to different people. You know, for example, Huddersfield, as an experienced fast bowler, if he came to me as the captain or the coach and said, listen, today I bowled, I mean, over the last week I bowled 35 overs in the game. I just want to run through 3 or 4 overs here just to get my groove, and that's me for training. You're more likely to say to him, okay, you know, you've done the hard work. Versus a young guy who's been bowling wides all over, and you say to him, listen, you actually need to put in some hard work. You need to bowl yourself 10 overs, you know, over the week in the nets to get ready for the next game. You know, it's easy to say, oh, double standard, Skip. Why is he doing that? Why is he not? And I don't buy into that, because you've got to be different. You know, a rugby player, a prop forward, doesn't train the same way as the wing. Mm. You know, we need some differentiation, and even in the same play, he's going to change over time. I mean, the way I trained as a 23-year-old compared to as a 33-year-old, completely different. You know, if you didn't know, you would say, oh, Stephen's work ethic's gone down. but the fact is, I got to a stage where I didn't need to do as much anymore to maintain that. I needed to be physically fresh. I didn't recover as well that I did. You know, if I batted all day and got 100, I'd feel it the next day. At 23, it'd just carry on. It wouldn't make any difference, you know. So, and I think, you know, the same applies to a Maverick player. You've got to allow that guy that ability to have the space to do what he can do, win new games, be exceptional. But not to the fact that being exceptional drags 10 other guys down so that it doesn't matter what his performance does. You know, if you end up with a guy who goes and scores 100 or 50 balls, but your team gets bowled out for 130 and you lose, well, it doesn't actually matter. I'd rather that guy go, maybe not even be in the side, and you get to 200 and win. You know, maybe that's better for the team, because, no one's bigger than the team. So,
For me, in modern cricket, we've seen the rise of leadership groups in terms of a bunch of group of leaders that obviously try to shape the direction of the side, and obviously try to make sure that everyone, you know, as captain, you can't be looking at everything. So they help you in terms of managing the team and making sure that everyone is going in that right direction. I mean, you in that era as well, where you were, let's say you and the coach you were leading the side, and now there's more of this new generation now, where you've got other leaders that are obviously strong in terms of this direction to the team. How does, for you now as captain, see, I just want to know, how does that translate to the field in terms of your decision-making? Is that something that you are always bouncing off guys, or something that you took on, I mean, when you're on the field as the captain, you make decisions on your gut feel and how you wanted things to go?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in my captaincy experience, I tried a bit of both. I mean, what I alluded to earlier about not trying to be the same every year, trying to evolve and move on. So I try to operate different systems. I went from pretty autocratic one season, every decision I would take on board, but then, you know, it weighs heavily after a while. That's you've got to be pretty sure of yourself to go that route.
Do you remember that season?
you're gonna go down that route. It's not easy to going the leadership group way, very much a collaborative style, which makes it easier in one sense. You can always say, well, you know, hide behind the committee decision in a sense. But again, I think it's team dependent. It's who you've got. I'm not convinced that going for a massive leadership group is necessarily the right way. In some teams where you maybe are battling to bring in a certain part of the change room, you know, or a group of people who maybe not really aligned to you, it can work. There are pros and cons to it. I certainly don't profess to be able to do that. I mean, some teams operate with almost an informal one, but, you know, it can be so topical. I mean, leadership group can so easily be confused with a team clique. Mm-hmm. Now, the one's negative, you know. I know it's been thrown out about the approaches at some stage. You know, on the positive sense, it's a leadership group. On a negative sense, it's a clique, you know, controlling the narrative of the team. On the other hand, it's the senior players guiding younger players, which sounds all virtuous and good. So, I mean, the intentions are so great. The waters are muddied there. So, on the other hand, does anyone really want my way or the highway, you know, type of captain? I don't know either. You know, you need to have some sort of blend, and that's why leadership is tough. And I mean, getting back to something you said earlier, are we doing enough to develop leaders? Probably not. I mean, we could be, as a sporting industry, leaning on other industries a lot more. You know, you think about the corporate leadership and the training that goes into that, probably far beyond what we do in sport. There's definitely a lot of room where we could be, you know, identifying a group of leaders. You know, I mean, to give an example, I mean, when Dile Mokoetu at the Knights, the young guy who's gone to the Knights, I mean, he went there last year for his first season. I don't think he started in the first game of the season, but the last game of the season, he was captaining them in the semi-final when Python Bullion was injured. And I looked at him, and I mean, just from the outside, I mean, I've never sat in a team talk of his, but I looked at him and thought, geez, this guy's got a natural ability to captain. Obviously did South Africa under 19. You could see tactically why he was doing it, fields he was setting. You know, sometimes you see a captain, he sets funky fields, call them funky fields. They look fantastic, but they actually serve no purpose. They're a gimmick. Whereas I saw with him, he set funky fields, but there was a purpose. You could see exactly what his purpose was. That was proper captaincy, in my opinion. And I think I was commentating when I saw it, and I remember saying, that's leadership there. You know, he's a young guy, not necessarily massive standing in that change room, and yet everyone's bought into what he's doing there. That bowler is fully committed to what he's doing with his funky field. We've got these leaders. It's not like we don't have them. We've got these guys. We need to equip them, give them skills, so that as they rise through the levels, even if they jump levels quickly, they've got some sort of basis, and they're not just, you know, going into it. Because, I mean, if you think that someone's just going to learn from watching, they are, but it's not the be all and end all. And I can speak for myself. Had I, and the fault lies with me. It was only my fault. It was always available to me. I could have gone out there and see things. But had I put more into my leadership, into the learnings about how leadership works, how to deal with, I could have been a far better captain. Definitely. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess also ultimately, when you think of the great captains in history, you know, Graham Smith, Steve Waugh, Clive Lloyd, etc. It also helped that they could toss the ball to the likes of Dale Steyn and Glenn McGrath, that Shane Warne, that great West Indian attack. I mean, I once asked Gavin Hunt, the football manager, you know, what is kind of the art of good management? And he said, it's easy, just go get some good players. and you know, he was tongue in cheek, but I wondered if so much of being a good captain is just the luck of having a good team. I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, if I was captaining Shane Warne and Glenn McGrath, I mean, you know, I'm so far away from being an international cricketer, but I figured if I was standing at mid-off, I'd also probably get, you know, devise a plan that would come up with wickets if I had those two guys bowling. I mean, how much of it is just pure luck?
Yeah, I mean, it is. The team's important. But even if you have that really good team, there's still parts to it, you know? Mm-hmm. I had that one year. The year we won the four-day competition, the Sunfoil Series, we had a bowling attack: Rabada, Fuldoon, Morris, Sotsobe, Pretorius. Five seamers there. Yeah. Playing 3-4 games at the Wanderers. I mean, literally, it was 3 slips of gully, short leg, and come in all day, you know. And then when we played on conditions that turned, we left out one of our seamers. We had Eddie Lee, who, you know, really good attacking leg spinner, googly variations. There was nowhere to hide. I mean, literally, it was plug in and play. Just make sure the camp was happy, bowlers were happy, and off we went, you know. Yeah. It was batter's job, really, and that's where the captaincy came in. There was to say, right, batters, we need to give these guys just enough runs to do their stuff. They'll win us. They'll win us this thing. We just need to score just enough runs, you know. And so that season for me, that was my challenge. It wasn't my bowlers. It wasn't my on the field. It was making sure that my batters didn't get a complex that they, you know, guys, we're going to play on green wickets. You know, I don't need whinging batsman, you know. There's actually the skill that year.
No, for sure. All right, should we get into the meaty part? I suppose you could say, to round it off. Let's get into our shortlist. How you want to do this, Norn? Should we go 1-1, or should I just roll them off and we talk about their pros and cons? Why don't I just do it?
Yeah, roll them off. We'll go from there. Yeah.
Let's start with so we got it down to a couple. Themba Bavuma. Let's start with him. Pros, he's got experience at domestic level, as you guys have said. You've both seen firsthand his captaincy at that level. I think maybe from the outside, maybe you guys can talk about this. I think captaincy is probably, he's probably one of those players where his game would actually improve with the armband. Obviously, there's the advantage of transformation. You know, having a black African skipper the test side would be huge. But I guess counting against him is that he's not necessarily guaranteed a spot in the side. And the lack of runs has been a bit of an issue. Steve, you handled the baton to him. What's your impression of Themba as a captain? Can he lead the Proteas at test level?
Yeah, I think Themba is a good leader. I think what his special ability is, he's able to just push guys' buttons in a positive way. He'll ask you that tough question. He won't shy away from it. He'll challenge. Just because you're doing that and it's worked, doesn't mean it's the best way. And I think that's important as a leader too. I think he will have a lot of credibility as a captain. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, maybe, you know, the fact that he's not a definite in your test team, I mean, he arguably should be. I mean, but I mean, as you mentioned, you know, a couple of runs, you making a captain, maybe it improves his performance. And I felt that personally. I mean, I felt that sometimes captaining takes a bit of focus off you as a player. You get out there, you think about the team, and you actually play better. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly think he's up near the top of the options, definitely.
Mm. Second one is someone I've actually seen rise up in the recent years, leading the Dolphins really well, Keshav Maharaj. We've seen that. I mean, he had to really work hard to be where he is as a spinner, first of all, in South Africa. And we know about his work ethic and the fact that you mentioned earlier that does that mean now we do play the spinner throughout our grounds in South Africa? So what do you think of his prospects, Stephen, of obviously being put in charge of the test side?
Yeah, I mean, I've always probably personally sided with having a batsman as captain. As I mentioned earlier, I think it's sometimes difficult for a bowler because then you committed, well, for the seamers, potentially injury keeps your captain in and out of the team. But for a spinner, injury, obviously less so, but condition dependent. But I do think on the positive side, he's got an excellent cricket brain. He captains the Dolphins. He's proactive. He's intelligent about what he wants to do. And I think he's one of those guys who likes to be in the game. The more he's in the game, the better the more you get out of him. Same thing with the batting. You know, when he's in the game, you get the most out of him. He's got that fighter in him. So yeah, probably like if you surveyed 1,000 people, probably one of the less likely, the less favorable candidates. But certainly, if you went for him, you could see why. There'd be enough reasons to justify why. Yeah.
Yeah, I must say in a chat with Nons that wasn't recorded for technical reasons. I kind of dismissed Keshav, but after chatting with you guys and hearing your thoughts about his cricket brain, I must say I've changed my tune a little bit. I mean, I never quite considered, maybe that's a bias from mine that I can't quite picture the spinner leading the test team, but you know, like you say, if he's the right guy, he's the right guy. Which leads us to Rusty van der Dissen. You know, he's someone who a couple of years ago obviously wasn't in the picture at all. He's a little older, a little street smart. Fuff in presses and in chats with journos spoke very highly of his leadership abilities. He also seems like a guy who's socially switched on and kind of understands the politics of South Africa. He was one of the few white guys who, in light of Black Lives Matter movement, he threw his weight behind Lungi and his comments. But is that enough to see him in the running? I mean, is the lack of experience, of leadership experience, actually something that would count against him? Never mind the fact that he's only played, a handful of tests. I mean, is Rusty just a complete outsider for you, or does he have a chance?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, you've listed a couple of good pros and cons there. I mean, for Rusty, I think he might be more of a front runner than maybe some people give credit for. Mm. You know, depending on the route you want to go, he's one of those guys because of how his career has risen, and maybe in the teams that he played in, he didn't necessarily get that captaincy experience. He always played in a team that I played in, or Temba was playing in, or Neil Mack was playing in, or Elvira was playing in. So never really got the armband, yet naturally is a leader. I mean, Nons will know, one of the guys who's most able to bring a dressing room together. Those other skills, he's good with the media. He's got his finger on the pulse of what's going on. And in the one-day cricket, he's taken to the one-day cricket really well. He's shown he can deal with pressure. He can, perform in the bigger stage. And yes, limited experience at test cricket, but if that's the punch you want to take and say, okay, well, we're willing to go down this direction, then, yeah, I suppose he does tick a number of boxes in that way. You are committing. You're saying, okay, Rusty van der Dissen is going to be our number four or number five or whatever, wherever you decide to bat him. But, yeah, I think off his track record and his first-class record, chances are he'll be able to do it. So yeah, I don't think we should discount him at all in the discussion. No.
I think as you said, I think in terms of stability as well, probably that's one of the things that it gives him, someone that is available for all your formats as well, and is someone that has shown in recent times that he's got what it takes to obviously play test cricket for South Africa. So it does also make sense from that point of view to, if you had to choose someone that ticks all the boxes, if one may say. Up next, we've got Aiden Markram. Someone who's actually we say he's the only captain in South Africa to win the World Cup, or player to win the World Cup, even though it's at junior level, SA under 90. And we know that he was given the leadership role under Otis Gibson as well, which also gives him an inside lane of having that experience. He's done it as well with the Titans. What do you think about his chances now, that the fact that he's also coming from the outside, similar to Temba, that they haven't been in the side? We've seen that Malan has been given that chance to open the batting. So does that now change things for him to come in? Maybe someone who will be similar to Graham Smith, you're backing him, the fact that he's still young and he's got so many years to captain the side. Would you think that's someone that they could throw it to?
Yeah, they could. They absolutely could go Aiden Markram. Yeah, very much in the line of how you went with Graham Smith, that sort of way. Obviously, I think he captained against India, if I'm not mistaken, in that series. And I mean, it didn't go well that well. I mean, India were a strong team, so I mean, that aside, I mean, wasn't an easy task. Yeah, I mean, his form over the last little while is maybe something that's a bit worrying, but I think he's a class player, and I think he will rise to the top. I certainly see him at the top of our order, captain or not captain, in the foreseeable future. So as for that, I think he's in. I played under him for SAA right at the back end of my career, and I was really impressed with his leadership in all facets, really. So, yes, youthful, but maybe not scarred, and whether that's being slightly scarred by being dropped in the experiences, that can enhance you. I mean, you can become better for that. So maybe that'll actually improve him as a captain. But I think definitely one of the front runners. I mean, for a long time, he's been seen as sort of the succession plan. And maybe his relative lack of success against spin, particularly, and in recent times, and obviously had a couple of injuries and, you know, some self-inflicted, some others not. I think definitely one of the main contenders, to be honest.
You guys talk about Graham Smith and how Aiden would be something quite similar. And I wonder if there's a tendency in cricket to try and elect the dynastic captain, and that kind of blinds people, blinds selectors and coaches from just kind of looking at a situation saying, what we need right now is a safe pair of hands for a couple of years. We don't have to select our 10-year captain now. And that kind of brings us to our last candidate, Dean Elgar. You know, senior guy, he's got a relationship with Mark Boucher. He wants it. He hasn't been as overt as others in recent times with the media, but we've heard him speak about how he does want the captaincy. He's certainly put in the hard yards, and he's a grizzled, you know, sort of, he's kind of made to be a test leader. You can kind of see him toughing out a tough session against Australia or India. Is it a bit short-term thinking to give it to Dean, or is that kind of what's actually needed right now?
Yeah, I think getting back to your leaders, your leader and your leadership style has got to match what your team, how your team's going to play, how you want your team to be. You know, if you're wanting that gritty, maybe slightly more short-term, Dean, probably your most proven performer in terms of runs, most, you know, pretty much a certainty on your team sheet, then yeah, you go down that road and say, okay, well, maybe that's a 2-year project while we groom the next guy. You know, you can go down that route, but and this is probably where I'm going to get to with my point, because I've sounded like I've sat on the fence a little bit, and I probably have, but that's because I'm not the one designing the top structure. Mm. You know, if you're the director of cricket, if you're the head coach, you're determining where we're going over the next period of time. What's important? What are our core values? What is the culture? Are we going to be a tough, rough South African team? You know, we're going to be fighters. We're going to be whatever. Then you pick a leader who can play that role. Or are you going to be a little bit softer, a little bit gentler, a little bit of a kinder team? Then you have that sort of type of leader who can pull that off. Are you going to say, right, we're going to not worry about our test actual performances for the next year or two, we'll grow into someone. Then you go a little bit more long-term. You go Markram or someone that can grow into the role. I think it would be unfair to sort of pick the captain and then try figure out a way of playing. I think you need to figure out a way of playing, a culture of what your team looks like. What does South Africa Proteas team 2020 and beyond look like? Certainly in the next couple of years. I mean, you can't plan too far ahead, and then pick your captain according to those ideals. Or even your captain, vice captain, if it's going. And in the white ball stuff, we've got Quinton, and I think that matches up well. That seems to match up well, shall I say, in terms of what's the style of play, how are we looking to play it, and then Quinton actually fits that style of leadership in terms of how you want to play. And I think that's your identity, and that's really important, you know. And it's, what you said, Dan, is very important, that, you know, because you had a Graham Smith who played a certain way, the team had a way of playing under Graham. That was the way the team played, those players. And so you could have a captain like that. You look at Brendan McCullum, New Zealand. They had a way of playing, and his leadership worked with that way that they wanted to play. So they go hand in hand. So, you know, my way would be to go, let's figure out our style of play, how we want to play in South Africa, and then go from there.
Steve, before we let you go, we're not going to let you off the hook quite so easily. We're going to ask you to stick your neck out and select one from our shortlist. And you've been very diplomatic, and we've given pros and cons for all of them. So this is by no means a, a lopsided debate. But if you had to, if you had to select it, and obviously, you know, all things considered, the style of play, the captain suiting that style of play, etc. But kind of removing that aside, who would you like to see selected for that, for South Africa's next test?
South Africa's next test captain. Oh, the golden question, yeah.
Yeah.
If it was probably purely up to me, and I mean, like, I can't say it's a clear cut winner. They've all got pros and cons.
Yeah.
To me, I would go, and I'm so tied up between Rassie or Temba.
Hmm.
And purely based on what I said just now about what is the style of cricket I would want to play. How would I, if I was the director of cricket, what is our style of play? And I think those two guys could most closely resemble this type of Proteas team that I would want to put together. If you said, Stephen, you're director of cricket or you head coach, that's probably the way I would go at this stage, taking into account what the players we've got. But I wouldn't take an ultra long-term view. I'd say we're a team very much transitioning. Everything about cricket at the moment is very fluid. Everything that we're going through, off the field, on the field, it's very fluid. And I would look to a leader who can deal with that nature of where we're at as a country, where we're at as cricket in this country, and navigate those waters. If he becomes your long-term option, well, great. If after 2 or 3 years, that's not the way you want to go and someone else emerges, well, you can go down that route. So, yeah, hard to say exactly one, but I would say those two guys probably the closest for me in terms of those ideals.
Yeah. No, Stephen Cook, thank you so much for your time. Since you guys have actually shared a field and I've just interviewed you as a journo trying to get the inside story, I'll let Nons have the final word in the chat.
Oh, you just threw me under the bus there. No, I think it's always insightful to listen to Stephen's thoughts. I want to say Cookie. Not a lot of people might refer to him in that way, but I'm also learning to use that word. But certainly one of those people for me that you could always listen and learn from. So I'm really grateful for that he joined us and shared his views on captaincy. It's always great to listen and learn from people's different point of views, and he's definitely been one. I played most of my franchise career under him. There's definitely been a lot of learning as well. So thank you for joining us and sharing your views.
No, pleasure. It's been great talking cricket. It's what I love. It's what I have a passion for. And so, yeah, always happiest talking cricket. Can't watch it at the moment very much. So, yeah, let's talk it.
Short, fine legs.
Well, that's our show this week. Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for sticking with us. And, of course, thank you to Stephen Cook. And thank you to Nons for hooking that chat up. Going through the Rolodex and going through your old contacts list there, finding your old skipper. Thanks, Nons. Thank you to our producers, Raider Media. Just go give them some love, because, really, in the South African media landscape, these guys are doing some great, great things. They've got a hockey podcast. They've got a sports quiz that is now on Super Sports, I believe. Big ups to Derek and the team. Give us a follow. Nons, you're on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. We're on Twitter at @short_fine_legs. Nons, any parting words? What are you looking forward to this weekend?
It's definitely crickets on TV. Looking forward to the second test. Yeah. Been keeping an eye on that, and fingers crossed Baba does deliver for me. I enjoy cricket a lot more when England is not doing well. So last week didn't go down well for me. So I'm hoping that they'll come back this weekend again. I think getting closer to that level 2 in South Africa as well. So if we continue in this path, I think cricket will be closer and closer every week.
No, I will. All right. Cheers, guys. Thanks.